You're listening to the Alan Gray Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Acker. It's great to be here for our first podcast of the year. 2025 was a year of contrasts. On the one hand, we saw markets reaching historic highs, including high returns from emerging markets like South Africa. Investors grappled with sweeping political changes and sluggish economic growth, other than the US, which has had a strong economy. So while on the one hand, returns have been very good, on the other hand, the environment has felt quite risky and uncertain. We know that especially during times of market uncertainty, how investors behave is crucial to their long-term investment outcomes. In today's conversation, we're going to be taking a closer look at how our biases and behaviors shape long-term investment success. Joining me to explore this topic, I'm very excited to have Dr. Daniel Crosby, who is a psychologist and one of the leading experts in behavioral finance. Daniel has written numerous award-winning books, including a New York Times bestseller, and his latest release, The Soul of Wealth, has already been translated into 5 languages. Daniel, it's great to have you with us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me, Tim.
So I want to jump right into this intersection that you've written about in many of your books between human psychology and markets, and really this kind of space in between, and also the meaning people attach to these topics like wealth and money. But maybe before we get into it, just your background, what should listeners know about just your journey getting into the space and what's influenced you to write about these topics?
Yeah, so it's a little bit of a circuitous journey. I have a PhD in clinical psychology, so I did not set out to work in financial markets. I set out to be a clinical psychologist, a therapist, if you will, but quickly burned out on that work and really found that I had a love for thinking deeply about why people do the things that they do, but didn't necessarily want to do that in a medical context. And so I approached my father at my young age when I was wrapping up my PhD, and I said, look, you know, said as much to him. And my dad is a financial advisor. And he said, this is, you know, 17, 18 years ago. And he said, look, I don't know if there are any jobs in this, but I know there's a lot of psychology in my work. I know that I am basically a de facto counselor for my clients, and it might be interesting for you to see if there's any work to be done with financial advisors. This was sort of the early days of the rising popularity of behavioral finance, but there wasn't much being done in terms of application, and there wasn't really anyone serving as a translator between the ivory tower of academia and the boots on the ground of everyday professionals working with clients. And so that's the niche I've tried to fill. That's the role I've tried to fill, is taking the insights of the brightest academic minds and sort of translating them in a way that works for clients and advisors.
Yeah, it's interesting that phrasing you use of being a translator, because you've come at it from a different angle, from being a psychologist. And it sometimes feels to me as an investor like we're all trying to become psychologists. We're trying to understand. We know we make all these mistakes, but like, how do we actually understand? You know, what can we do about it?
Sure.
So that's interesting. Jumping into this topic of behavioral biases, you know, we all read about these things. They've all got these different names, you know, overconfidence, anchoring, like all these things we hear about. And what I found quite useful in your work is you have this framework of breaking it up into these 4 categories. So if I've got it right, the ones you list are ego, attention, emotion, and conservatism as sort of 4 categories of biases. So just briefly explain that framework, sort of the different categories, and why you think it makes sense to think of them in these buckets.
Sure. So you're absolutely right. There's now over 200 different cognitive biases that psychologists like myself have identified, where people have these cognitive errors that lead them to make mistakes with their money. But of course, you or I sitting down with a client we're trying to serve and telling them that there's 200 ways to get this wrong is not a particularly useful or heartening comment for them. And so what I did with some of my early work and my early writing is I entered into these 200 with sort of no preconceptions about how many meta biases would fall out. As I looked at these, I said, look, there's some root behavioral causes that underlie these. And I really came out with the 4 you talked about. So I'll touch on them briefly, and then we can go into more depth if you'd like. But ego is the various forms of overconfidence. So we as a human family on average think that we are smarter, better, faster, stronger than average. And we are induced to think like this because it makes us feel good. I mean, it helps us get out of bed in the morning and it helps us, you know, put on our shoes and go out into the cruel world to think that, you know, we're a little bit luckier than average. We're more prescient about the future and we're more talented. This is a bias that serves us very well. You know, it leads us to go talk to the good looking person at the bar. It leads us to start a business, even though from a probabilistic standpoint, starting a business is a, you know, on average, a losing endeavor. It causes us to take a lot of risks that often serve us very well. But in financial markets, this overconfidence can really lead us astray. The second one is emotion. This is just what it sounds like. It's the tendency for us to use our heart over our head when making financial decisions and to use emotion as a form of sort of risk assessment, which can often lead us astray. We've got attention, which is the human tendency to confuse things that are loud with things that are likely. And, you know, one of the examples that I give of this is in the months following 9/11 here in the U.S., people were very reticent to fly for reasons that, of course, we all understand. You had had this very high profile terror attack that involved airplanes. People are understandably a little bit reticent to get on an airplane. So what people did was they started to drive en masse where they might have flown before. And so in addition to the thousands of deaths from 9/11 itself, in the remaining months of that year, we had thousands and thousands more excess auto deaths because people were trying to avoid a loud risk of something like terrorism, which is low probability but high profile. And instead, they got in their car and were subjected to a much more likely risk that is not as newsworthy, but is more likely that you get in an auto accident. And so that's something that we get wrong. We fall prey to these sort of low probability, but high sort of high intensity news headlines and let them misguide our thinking. And then the last one is conservatism, which is our tendency to be risk prone, loss prone, uncertainty prone, and to confuse things that we know with things that are good. We see this all over the world that people tend to overinvest in their home country. They tend to overinvest in their industry. And this actually leads to a doubling and tripling of risk because if I'm an American, my job is dependent on the fortunes of America. You know, the worth of my home is dependent on the fortunes of America. And now I'm sort of doubling down on American investments. I've really sort of stacked my risks instead of becoming a cross-cultural, cross-border investor. So we're sort of provincial as a human family in the different ways that we can be comfortable with things that are familiar and sort of small-minded is this conservatism risk.
Yeah. A lot of those, when you go through them, immediately can sort of resonate with them when you talk about, you know, overconfidence. If you're involved in the market at all, you know, it's something you're very familiar with, or getting swept up in emotion or on attention, just the news cycle. And, you know, the market is so short-term focused. There's just something everyone in the market focuses on today, and tomorrow it's a different thing, or, you know, Trump announces something else and everyone's focused on that. So these definitely resonate. I guess what you mentioned earlier on, you know, these 200 plus biases, it's almost like overwhelming, right? You think like there's so many things that I can do wrong. It's almost like, what's the point trying to think about it? So maybe sort of boiling it down to common causes can help us in some way try and make sense of all of this.
That's exactly right. So I recently went on a health journey and lost a bunch of weight and got in shape. And the way that I was able to do this, you can't boil the ocean. I focused on two things, two inputs, and that was it. Like, that's kind of all I could focus on was calories and protein. And, you know, I think something similar is afoot with this world of behavioral risk. You can't mitigate against 200 plus behavioral risks. but you can design a planning and an investing paradigm that is robust against those four. So that's what I wanted to do, winnow it down to a workable universe of risk.
Okay. Yeah. Because something I often wonder about when I read about these biases is, does it actually help to know about them? If there's some specific bias that, you know, you can read it and you can think like, oh, that really makes sense. You know, I've seen other people do that, or maybe I've even kind of seen myself do that. But just, does the mere knowing about a bias actually help at all? Or is it sort of give you, does it just give you a false sense of security?
So it's a great question. Maybe the most important question. So I think there's three things that we need. I call it the three E's. If we want to change a behavior, there's three things that we need. The first is education. So that's what this is all about. Like, knowing about these investor biases is a form of education, but education is a weak predictor of behavior. You know, the sort of the silly example I give here in the US is that doctors and nurses smoke cigarettes in the US at a rate higher than the general population. Doctors, it's slightly higher. Nurses, it's way higher.
Oh, wow. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's nearly double. And so if you ask the average nurse, like, hey, should you be like, is smoking cigarettes good for you? Every single one of them would tell you no. And yet, you know, they work long hours. They have stressful jobs. They smoke cigarettes for many reasons that have nothing to do with thinking it's a good for your body. And I think the same thing is true of us with biases. So education is sort of necessary, but not sufficient. The second layer, which is arguably the most powerful, is the environment. What knowing about these biases does is it allows you to create an environment that is robust to these biases, right? So you say, look, I know I'm overconfident. I know I have ego. So when my statement comes in every month from my advisor, rather than reading it and worrying about what happened, I'm going to rip it up and forget about it and just, you know, not even look at it and just go on my way. So this is sort of a silly, simple example, but the environment is a much better predictor of what you're going to do with your money than your knowledge or your education. And then the third one is encouragement. Having that coach, having that advisor in your corner who can help you do the right thing at that moment when it may be the hardest. So knowing about these biases in and of itself, I think, is a weak predictor of doing the right thing. But if you surround yourself with the right people, the right support, and the right environment, I think you have very good likelihood of doing that. And knowing about those biases is a prerequisite to that, to those three facets, those three E's.
Okay. And I guess one can probably apply this at different levels. So you have financial advisors who might be listening to this, so they can sort of think, how can they apply this for clients? But also, if you're a client yourself, or you, there's some of these systems you can probably incorporate as well. Are there examples, you think, for individual investors, some practical things that systems or like things you've seen in practice that sort of work well?
Yeah. So one of the most powerful things an in-client, an average investor can do, you know, we talked about conservatism earlier, and one facet of this is that we're sort of, as a human family, lazy and status quo prone and forgetful. There's lots of ways in which that reality can make you a poor investor. I mean, I think there's many obvious ways in which being lazy and status quo prone and forgetful would lead you to make poor decisions with your money. But if you automate your financial life, if you automate, like, look, once a month when I get paid, you know, a portion of that is coming out and going to be auto invested and auto saved, and I'm never even going to see it. That's a way in which we can take our laziness and our forgetfulness and our status quo proneness and actually make it work for us. So, you know, something like that is a very simple example of how being aware of a bias and making it work for you instead of against you is something simple but powerful. And it's highly predictive of people's terminal wealth, is whether or not they automate versus trying to do the right thing, you know, every 2 weeks when you get paid. That takes a lot of willpower. That takes a lot of consistency. Don't rely on willpower. Don't rely on consistency. Just set it and forget it, as it were.
Right, just like changing the default, and that's just what you do every time without having to think about it. Yeah, I definitely find that it helps for me going to the gym. If I always say Monday evenings I go to the gym and it's non-negotiable, that's just, you don't have to wonder about it. This idea of sort of, you know, knowing what the right thing to do is versus actually doing it in practice. So you might study these biases and have an idea of what you're supposed to do. And I always think of the story, I'm sure you know the story about Stanley Druckenmiller, you know, very famous hedge fund manager, probably one of the best managers of all time. And he talks about in the dot-com bubble when he bought a lot of stocks sort of close to the top of the market and lost a lot of money. And people ask him afterwards, because he talks openly about this and how it was this big mistake. And people ask him about, you know, what did you learn from doing this? And he sort of famously said, I didn't learn anything. I already knew I wasn't supposed to do it. I just couldn't help myself. I got caught up with emotion. And I mean, that's definitely true in investing, like speaking for us as fund managers, the mistakes we make, advisors, end clients, that, you know, there are lots of things we know we're supposed to do. And it's harder to do in practice, right? Just talk about this gap between sort of knowing and doing.
Yeah. So, you know, it's whether it's doctors and nurses smoking, Stanley Druckenmiller buying a bunch of inflated tech stocks that he knew not to do. You know, we all violate the things that we know to be right all the time. You know, before I lost weight, like I wasn't overweight because I didn't understand that chocolate wasn't good for me. You know, it's just chocolate is delicious. And so what do we have to do? Well, I'll introduce another framework here, and we can use the gym. We'll use your gym example because I think it's appropriate. So the framework is called EAST. And so to minimize this knowing doing gap that's so pervasive, there's four things we can do. The first is we can make the behavior easy. Right. So you talked about going to the gym on Monday. For me, one of the things that I did when I made health changes was my daughter goes to an early morning Bible study every day before she goes to school. And my wife had historically taken her, but I volunteered to take her. So at that point, I'm up, I'm dressed, I'm out of the house, I'm halfway to my gym. And I just made it easy. You know, I just made it easy for me to do the thing that I wanted to do. The A in EAST is for attractive, you know, so keeping on the theme of exercise. If you like playing tennis, play tennis. If you like hiking, go hiking. Like choose something that makes it attractive for you. You know, do the thing that you want to do. Try and align that goal with something you enjoy already, rather than saying, well, I'm going to do, you know, I'm going to go grind it out on a treadmill if that's not what you enjoy doing. The S is for social. We know that people who reach their financial goals and their fitness goals often have someone in their corner, whether it's that advisor, your spouse, your gym buddy, whoever it may be. We are herd creatures. Now, Stanley Druckenmiller followed the herd into a bad investment decision, but just as easily we can follow the herd into a good decision if we're surrounding ourselves with people who are pursuing the same goals that we're after and have the same aims. And then the last one is timely. You know, you talked about every Monday, like I'm going to the gym. It's not a question anymore. You've locked that in a timely manner. For me, it was the same thing. You know, look, every morning at 6:45, like I'm out, I'm there, I'm halfway to the gym. We're just doing it. It's not a conversation every morning about, well, should I go to the gym or shouldn't I? That's just what I do at 6:45. So making that behavior easy, making it attractive, making it social, and making it timely, I think that's our best hope about overcoming this knowing doing gap, because most of us know the right things to do. I mean, most investors know that you should diversify and be patient. And, you know, that gets violated all the time, not because we don't know to do it, but because we're not doing these four things.
Right. And just thinking on today's environment specifically. So we've had very strong markets over the last few years. You know, a little bit of a correction, but you know, markets have still been, you know, quite strong. Do you think that in this kind of environment, are there specific biases you think we need to like really be watching out for when you've had a few years of very strong returns? Are there like specific ones that like, you know, now is really the time to be watching out for this or that mistake?
Certainly. I think the big one is recency bias. You know, one of the things that human beings do is that we So to rewind a bit, our brains account for about 2%, 2 to 3% of our body weight, but they take up 20 to 25% of our caloric expenditure on any given day. So your brain is this very energy inefficient, hungry part of you. And so as a result, you're always looking to streamline decision making. And one of the primary means by which we do that is that we project the recent past into the future indefinitely. So if I meet Tim and Tim is intelligent and kind and thoughtful, when I meet you again in 6 months, I don't go, gee, I wonder what Tim is like. I just assume you are what you ever were. And the same thing is true of markets. People really look at the last, 6 months to 5 years and then assume that the market will be like that forever, which is why in surveys of investors, at least here in the US, you see people assuming that markets will be getting 16 to 17% per year, which is dramatically higher than they have tended to do. And if your expectation is 17%, I mean, there's two problems. First of all, markets are mean reverting in the medium term. So a couple of years of 15 to 17% returns on average gets you a next few years of, 5 or 6% returns. So that's one thing, is you don't understand that these markets are mean reverting. And if anything, you should assume, just probabilistically speaking, that things will get worse than average. People instead assume that things will be better than average. Things will be like they have been. So I think that recency bias and that failure to sort of account for the tendency of markets to mean revert in the medium term, I think that's the biggest danger we face right now.
Yeah, we definitely see that in individual companies as well. When a business or stock has done well recently, people assume this is a great business, they're going to keep doing well. And
yeah,
that's an easy trap to fall into as investors as well. So maybe sort of on that line of thinking, we've been talking about advisors and individual investors, but what about professional investors? Do you think are we immune to some of these, or are we equally susceptible to all these behavioral biases?
What's interesting is behavior doesn't discriminate. And one of the most common misconceptions I hear from people is that, but professionals wouldn't do this because they know better. Or really wealthy people are a different animal. And, really wealthy people are sort of above the fray here and wouldn't do this. And that's absolutely not the case. I think your Stanley Druckenmiller example is appropriate here and is a perfect example of one of the all-time greats and one of the smartest people around falling prey to something very, very human in that hurting. And what's interesting in the research is we actually know that in some cases, being more intelligent than average can be to our detriment, because we can actually become quite skilled at, I'm trying to think of a better word for this, at fooling ourselves. We get good at, we're just smart enough to be self-deceptive. And that is a real risk. And so I think even professionals, people sort of marvel sometimes that I pay an advisor to manage my money. Now, my advisor has not written 4 books on behavioral finance. I have. Why am I paying someone good money to manage my money? Well, I know that if I write 100 books on behavioral finance, it won't be enough for me to stop being the very scared, frail human that I am and that we all are. So I think being a professional, being wealthy, being intelligent, these things are no cure for what ails humankind in this regard.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. Just from my experience, I think some of these biases like ego are probably as or more prevalent if you're a professional investor. It's very, like you say, it's very easy to fool yourself. It's very easy to read about these biases and say, I wouldn't do that. It's interesting, like I'm sure you know this research about checklists as well. Like when they say like doctors or pilots, the outcomes improve if you use like a simple checklist and it's the same as true in investing. And you'd think like, surely if you're an expert in your field, I don't need a checklist. This is sort of beneath me in some way. But actually, these systems actually do improve your outcomes, interestingly.
Yeah, one of the things that, I wrote about in The Laws of Wealth is that We think often, you think about the stock market, it's this complex dynamic system with effectively infinite inputs and just incredibly like overwhelmingly complicated and dynamic. And so people think that you need a system that's equally complicated and has equal dynamism to meet that. And yet what the research shows is to master a complex dynamic system, what you need is a checklist effectively, just to get a couple of things right. And so, you know, I've written about how behavior can be applied to, you know, asset allocation and picking better stocks. And really, it for me, my checklist is like three things. You know, I want to pay a fair price, I want a good company, and I want a little bit of momentum. I want a little bit of a head of steam. And like, that's it. I've not found much that can improve upon that. And that's sort of a shockingly simple thing for so dynamic a system. But that's what the research suggests works is checklists.
Interesting. Now, definitely in our experience as a firm and an investment team, we've over the years found quite a lot of benefit in systems and processes to assist and check kind of investment decision making. Simple things. Clients are sometimes surprised, you know, the kind of things that are useful in terms of how you structure meetings, how you make sure there's not groupthink or an echo chamber, someone is dominating the discussion. Those things can be quite useful. I want to ask you, so you're yourself using a financial advisor, and people sometimes talk about this idea of a behavior gap. So sort of the outcomes you get versus what you should have gotten and how advisors can reduce that gap. Just in your view or your experience, what is sort of the mechanism that actually on reducing that behavior gap? Is it just like reducing mistakes? Is it stopping the investor from selling at the wrong time? Or what are sort of the big drivers or levers that reduce that behavior gap?
So it's a great question. We actually have really good research on this. There was a meta-analysis that came out in 2016. So a meta-analysis would be a study of all of the studies looking at how financial advisors add value to their clients' lives and dollars and cents value. And what the study found was, first of all, everything an advisor does is additive. You know, whether we're talking about tax optimization or product selection or asset allocation, all of these things are additive. And they add about 30 to 60 basis points per year. So anywhere from about a third to a little better than half of 1 percentage point per year to the returns of an investor, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it's enormous over time.
So it's quite meaningful. Yeah.
That's big. Yeah. It's enormous over time when you compound it. But what's fascinating from this same meta-analysis is whereas something like asset allocation, so, you know, picking the mix of stocks and bonds and alternatives that are in a portfolio, that adds, you know, 30 to 40 basis points per year. Behavioral coaching, so keeping the client from their own worst impulses, added on average 240 basis points per year.
Wow.
So it creates this interesting divide where the average investor is seeking out an advisor ostensibly to get the right mix of stocks and bonds, which is helpful, but not nearly as helpful as using that advisor as a decisional guide and having that advisor keep you from tripping over your own feet. And so it's sort of a weird paradox that the thing that people expect their advisor to do most profitably and the thing their advisor does most profitably are different things. But there's no doubt that on average, people who work with advisors do better. As a psychologist, some of the most interesting research around this shows that people who work with an advisor are less likely to get divorced. They have better marital communications. They're more prepared for a natural disaster. I mean, there's sort of all of these ancillary benefits that come from working with an advisor that are sort of off label, but I think still powerful.
So do you think, should advisors be sort of like quantifying this almost as their sales pitch or telling clients at the end of the year, this is how much money I saved you from, maybe phrase it differently, from doing stupid things, but from behaving suboptimally, say?
So it's interesting. You know, I talked about what people are looking for and what advisors doing well being sort of different things. When you look at research on what people value from their advisors, something like keeps me from making boneheaded decisions is the absolute bottom of the list. So admitting that requires the average person to admit that they are prone to do stupid things with their money. And that's because of this ego. That's not something that many of us routinely admit. However, so I do think it's a little bit of a losing battle because the advisor is at that point, you know, trying to convince the person of their own fallibility, which I think is sort of a losing battle. But, you know, the same research shows that things like my advisor listens to me and helps me achieve my goals is the number one thing that people are looking for.
Okay, interesting.
You know, that's behavioral finance too. So I think there's a way to emphasize the good that we do from a relational or a behavioral perspective, but it's usually in the affirmative and not in the negative of saying, look at all the dumb things you might have done without me. That's a hard pill for most people to swallow.
Yeah, so it's an interesting comment you made now on people wanting to be felt that they heard and understood, and that maybe sort of what, for an example, a financial advisor, the service they're selling and what the client wants from them, there's a little bit of a mismatch where people are getting this benefit, which is not, the advisor might not realize that this, I'm sure many advisors do realize people actually want a little bit of a therapist as well. And maybe, you know, there's value in sort of being aware of that and tweaking the service in some way, if that's what clients actually want.
Well, I think there was an Accenture study that came out a few years ago that asked people what they were looking for from a relationship with an advisor. And the number one answer was, I want to be heard and understood. That is a deeply human desire, is to be seen, to be understood. And I think it's a prerequisite to, you know, the very fundamentals of our business, creating a personalized financial plan, creating a good allocation. I think you've got to hear that person and know that person first. So that's a great example of sort of a behavioral principle that people are looking for that I think is an easy sell. And if we increase the way we do discovery, we increase our due diligence on the front end as an industry, I think people would feel more seen, better understood, and we could serve them better for sure.
When I read sort of these topics in one of your books, it got me thinking about us as an investment manager. So Allen Gray, the firm, we manage clients' money, and we always kind of assume we send the client a statement at the end of the month, and we sort of implicitly assume what clients actually just care about the returns. They just want to know sort of how much money we've made for them, which obviously is what we're focusing on, and it's obviously extremely important. But there probably are other things clients want from us as well. They want to make sure we can be trusted and our values align, and, you know, what causes the firm is supporting, and some of these other issues. And I don't know if you have thoughts on this. Maybe there are things we should be, that our clients might want from us or want to know from us, that we should probably be talking about more.
So there's a useful framework when we are evaluating a person. There's really two axes, there's two dimensions along which we evaluate a person and decide whether or not they're someone we want to do business with or want to be friends with. And one of them is warmth and one of them is competence. If I'm an Allen Gray client and you are not making me money, that is incompetence, right? Like if you are not, you know.
Yeah, makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah. So of course that has to be part of the equation, and that's a critical part of it. But I do think that the warmth piece is interesting as well, because, you know, people, if you think about, you know, sort of the 4x4 matrix that those two dimensions would create, someone who is very, very competent, but not at all warm, that's an enemy. Like that's someone to be feared, someone who is skilled, but doesn't have our best interests at heart, or someone who is very, very warm, but incompetent. That's just sort of a lovable loser, I guess, sort of a goofy, you know, a goofy person.
Yeah. Well, like the first example would be like the doctor without bedside manner, who he might be good, but you sort of don't have a good vibe.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And then, you know, the other one would be the doctor that's cracking jokes, but doesn't know what they're doing. Yeah. So I think even as firms, even at the firm level, even at the corporate level, we want to model both of those things. We want to be highly skilled, highly competent, but also warm and human. And I think that's how we engender trust.
Okay. Just one sort of related topic I wanted to ask you, since we're talking about how we communicate with our clients is, you know, I mentioned we send our clients our statements every quarter with their investment returns. And you also made the comment, you know, for many clients, it's probably better to not look at their statement too often. And this is a sort of message we, you know, obviously we want to keep our clients informed, but at the same time, we often tell clients you should invest for the long run. And especially if you're investing in equities and you have a long investment horizon, actually it's probably better to not look at your statement too often. Mm-hmm. Do you think we should be giving clients like actual options in that regard? Like actually ask them, do you want to receive a statement every month? Maybe once a year is enough. I sometimes wonder like these private equity and private credit funds, which have become very popular, you know, and are not as liquid, you know, maybe there's a bit of a feature there in not being able to see the money, the balance in your account change every day, the up and the down. And it actually is a bit less comfortable for it to be sort of out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah, there's, you know, to the example that I would give is, you know, you think about, I don't know how it is in South Africa, but for in the US at least, and I imagine there, you know, many people's largest asset, most valuable asset is their home. Now, if I had, you know, of course, the value of your home fluctuates every day, but we don't have a sign in our front yard that in the evening when I pull into my driveway, it says, well, I've lost $50,000 on the value of my home today. And I don't worry about that because I don't see it.
Right.
Most people live in their home for 10 or 15 years and then they sell it and they know they made money. And then that's lovely. And these private equity and private credit funds are the same way because they're not marked to market, you know, and there's usually a 5 to 10 year holding period. You have the price you went in at and then you know the price you get out at. And you don't worry about the heartache sort of between here and there. So, yeah, I think one thing that we know from the literature is that the more you look, the worse you worry. So if you think about, you know, the stock market, roughly speaking, it's up about 60% of days and down about 40% of days. But you also have to remember that people weight positive and negative outcomes very differently. We know from prospect theory that a loss hurts about 2.5 times as much as a gain feels good. Well, what's that 40% times 2.5? I mean, 40% times 2.5 is 100. So it's like if you're looking at your account every day, it feels like you're down effectively 100% of the time when you're not. You know, if you're looking at it every year or every 5 years or every 10 years, the less you look, the better the outcome. So look, I think you and I should design something that auto opts people in to receive statements once every 5 years. And then if they want to receive one every month or every quarter, they can make that change. But we auto enroll them in 5 years for their own good.
Yeah, I like that idea. That sounds good. One other topic I want to get your thoughts on is just around risk when we're investing. And the different ways people sort of define risk, there's sort of more academic ways. And I guess the sort of average investor has maybe a different way of thinking about risk. Just in your mind, if you had to sort of define or just kind of say, what do you think risk in investing is or how we should think about it?
Yeah. So if the market's definition of risk is volatility.
Yeah.
And I think the average investor's definition of risk is probably something like max drawdown or max pain. I would say that my definition of risk is not having what you need when you need it. My definition of risk would be extremely goals based. And you can heighten or lessen that degree of risk by having more or less extravagant goals. And you can heighten or lessen that risk by having a longer timeline. So I think all else equal, people would be smart to take longer timelines and have more conservative goals. But yeah, that's kind of how I think about it. Risk is like, you know, me not having the freedom to do what I want to do when I want to do it. That to me is risk.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me because the second question I wanted to ask, and maybe you can still comment on it, is what do investors miss or how does the wrong definition of risk lead you astray? You can definitely see how focusing on volatility could lead you astray. But even your other definition, which seems very accurate to me, of focusing on drawdown, that can also lead you astray. If you're very afraid of drawdowns and corrections, I mean, we often see lots of investors who are too conservative. They don't want to invest in the market because they're afraid there might be a correction, even though they're investing for a 20 or 30 year, you know, time horizon. So it ends up making them too conservative, which is also a mistake in a different direction.
Yeah, I think that is the biggest risk that most investors make, is that they're too conservative and they don't see that excessive conservatism as a form of risk. If you look at, you know, something like even stocks versus bonds, I mean, bonds are important. I own lots of bonds. I'm not poo-pooing bonds. But if you look at rolling long-term periods, stocks have beaten bonds in every single long-term period, and the real returns have been dramatically higher. When you disguise that, if you said, look, investor, would you rather have asset A, which wins in 100% of rolling 10-year periods and has an average real return of 7%, or would you rather have option B, which loses in every rolling 10-year period and has an average real return of 2%? Everyone is effectively going to say, I want asset A. And yet when you say, which is riskier, a stock or a bond, people will say, well, stocks are riskier. Even though stocks are behind door number one and bonds are behind door number two. So people think something like holding cash is not risky. Well, we know that inflation is 1,000% eroding that at 3-4% every year. That's risk. And so most people are more focused on that downside drawdown, that downside risk, and not focused enough on the loss of purchasing power or the fact that they won't be able to do the things that they want to do when they want to do them because they haven't compounded their wealth at a significant enough clip.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So another definition I often give is risk as the risk of permanent loss of capital. Mm-hmm. So when we invest in clients' money, we quite focus on this idea of, you know, of course we want to do better than the benchmark or the market, but we also want to take less risk doing so, and not necessarily defined as volatility, but just the risk of something really bad happening, right? Of like of a over concentration in your portfolio and something goes wrong and your clients end up losing a lot of money. But that's something that's quite hard to measure. Like you can't work it out, like volatility or the standard deviation of this or that. Or it's something that's hard to convey to a client that, you know, we've given XYZ return, but we've also taken less risk along the way. It's sort of hard to measure. Do you think that's something one can convey or try to communicate to clients in some way?
Oh, it's very hard because, you know, think about earthquake proofing a building and, you know, an earthquake comes, you know, think about an airbag. My car is 13 years old and it has airbags all over it and they've never deployed. So was it a waste of money to buy a car with an airbag? Like, no, I don't think so. I think that's how we have to think about it is, look, this is valuable. I mean, people buy insurance all the time. That never gets called. And, you know, you having life insurance isn't a bad idea if you don't die when you're 30. It's still a good thing to do, but it is admittedly hard to sell, you know, the airbag that never deploys.
Yeah. A last question on the topic of risk is, so I know people in a financial advice context often use things like risk questionnaires or assessments and try and, you know, categorize clients or investors, like this is a sort of a client with a higher risk appetite or a lower risk appetite. And, you know, based on that, this is the appropriate fund or vehicle or whatever. Do you think those things are useful at all? Like, do you think as humans, we actually any good at classifying ourselves and saying, you know, I'm okay with a higher risk, or actually, no, I'm not okay with a higher risk?
So I'm going to forget who said this, but there's this quote that all models are wrong. Some models are useful. And that's how I feel about risk tolerance questionnaires. All risk tolerance questionnaires are wrong and all of them are imperfect. But I don't think that their many imperfections should cause us to throw them out entirely. And, you know, what I've developed at Orion, where I work, is a risk tolerance questionnaire that includes a behavioral component to it. Because one of the things that we know about risk is, you know, going back to this knowing-doing gap, someone's risk tolerance is their long-term willingness to make risk-reward trade-offs in a cool, calm, emotional state. That's important to know, right? Like that's an important piece to know. But we also have something called risk composure, which is the likelihood that that cool, calm, emotional state gets disrupted. This is their emotional volatility, their behavioral volatility. And you have to measure those things in tandem to get a good sense of how to allocate that client. So I think, you know, most risk tolerance questionnaires are quite bad, in large part because they don't feature this behavioral component to it, which is absolutely critical.
Okay. So just recognizing the limitations, I guess. Great. I want to ask you one closing question just as we come to the end of the conversation. You've been doing this for a long time. Are there things you've changed your mind on in terms of behavioral finance beliefs? There are lots of sort of conventional wisdom or, you know, things you read in behavioral finance. Is there anything that you've sort of, you know, you started out thinking one way, but actually you've changed your mind on over the years?
Yeah, I think one thing I've changed my mind on directionally is the power of education versus the power of environment. I think early on, I wanted to believe that people could know thyself and develop a more heightened awareness of self, and that that would be largely sufficient to change behavior. Now I believe that environment is the biggest determinant. You know, if you wanted to change one thing, it would be to change environment. Another thing that I've tweaked my thinking on, my son takes karate. My son is a martial artist. And one of the things that they learn there is what's called the circular theory of self-defense, which is basically if someone throws a blow at you, if someone, you know, kicks you or punches you, the thing to do is to not block that, the full brunt of that punch. The thing to do is to sort of roll with that resistance and allow them to use their exertion against themselves. This is now how I think about behavior as well. Instead of trying to white knuckle our way past human tendencies, which are eons old, you know, things that have sprung up in human nature over many thousands of years because they're adaptive and they serve us well. Instead of trying to white knuckle our way past that or just brute force our way past that, we should think of a way to take that human tendency to plan for it and have it work for us. You know, the automation is a good example. Instead of not trying to be lazy, which I am deeply lazy, you know, let me make that laziness work for me instead. And that's another thing that I've changed my mind on is, yeah, like we're all human. I'm not going to try to be more than human. I'm just going to try and make that humanity work for me instead of against me.
Yeah, that's a very nice closing of the loop to where we started the conversation. We covered a lot of ground, and you've given me a little bit of hope that there's some practical things we can we can do. We don't need to change the way we wired. Maybe we can change environment, systems, processes, and try and combat some of these biases. Great. Thanks so much, Daniel. It was great having you on.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That brings us to the end of episode 32. Thanks again, Daniel, for joining us, and thank you to everyone for listening. A key takeaway for me from this conversation was that we could all benefit from learning a little bit more about psychology, and that there are actually some practical steps we can take to combat our own behavioral biases. If you would like to get in touch, please send an email to podcast@allengray.co.za. You can subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcasting platform to be notified of new episodes. Lastly, Allen Gray is an authorized FSP. To view our terms and conditions, please visit allengray.co.za. Until next time, I'm Tim Acker. This podcast was produced by Volume Podcasts.
Time. When you're a kid, it moves slower than a sloth trying to get through airport security. There is just so much of it. Skip forward a few years to your 20s. Time is still your friend. It says have some balance. Go party and have fun. Then your 30s hit. And time suddenly steps on the accelerator like it's trying to catch a traffic light before it goes red. 40s. Now time is moving faster than your 10-year-old on a sugar high. 50. You're desperately trying to save as much as you can, but time is moving so fast. And all you can think is, where did all the time go? That's why after 50 years of investing, we've learned that time is the greatest gift of all. And the good news is, if you invest early, time gives you money. And then money gives you more time for some much-deserved you time. Now, isn't that a compelling enough reason to invest? Ellen Gray, long-term investing. Ellen Gray is an authorized FSP.